2 Peter 2, verses 10b through 12, the eighth talk in a series on the book of 2 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on August 12, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are continuing in our series on 2 Peter. We are in chapter 2, which I find very tricky to work with. I've told you before that I really like chapter 1 and I really like chapter 3, and chapter 2 is tough to sort out what's going on. Peter is denouncing the false teachers in this section, and he does it in a way that is sometimes difficult to understand what's happening. We already talked about the fact that this chapter very closely matches the book of Jude. If you ever have a chance to compare them, they're very similar as they go along. Peter and Jude seem to be using material from books outside the Bible, which is another confusing thing about what they're doing. What are they thinking about the stories that they're drawing on? Do they think that those books were true and accurately portraying what happened? It's an interesting question. Today we're going to look at one more piece of the puzzle. I would say, let me just say as I start into this, this is kind of the last of the really hard pieces from my perspective. The rest from here on, at least I more or less know what I think is going on, and I think it's more straightforward seeing where Peter's coming from and what's happening. But today, we're in the last of those really weird pieces. I mean, we're talking really weird. So I'm just warning you as we go into this, I made this choice again. I could either have skipped it or not, and I decided not to skip it, so that means I'm going to try to take you in and talk about what's going on with this stuff, and there's a lot of little pieces to try to sort out. We're going to find issues of interpretation, that is, what exactly is it that Peter is saying, and we're going to find issues of application, that is, what is it that Peter really wanted us to get from this? When we're all done sorting this out, what was the point? Why was he saying this stuff? What does he want his readers to do? So hang on, and if you find this ride somewhat hairy, the weeks from here on I think will be a little easier sledding. We'll see. I may manage to make those tough too, but I'm going to try anyway. So we are in chapter 2. We're going to be starting with verse 10b. That is, we're in the middle of verse 10 in chapter 2 of 2 Peter. Chapter 2 is about God's coming judgment on the false teachers. And just before verse 10, Peter said that the Lord knows how to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its defiling desires and who despise authority. And in the context of chapter 2, it's the false teachers that he's talking about that meet this description. The false teachers indulge the flesh and despise authority. So that's where we are as we start into the middle of verse 10. Daring, arrogant, they do not tremble when they revile glories. We'll talk about that in a minute. Whereas angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them before the Lord. But these, like unreasoning animals, being born according to nature for capture and destruction, reviling things of which they have no knowledge, will in their destruction also be destroyed. Okay, so there are some tricky things to talk about in here. Let's talk first about the things that we can be fairly confident about. There are certain things that come forward that seem to make some sense. Not enough, but some. Peter calls the false teachers daring and arrogant, and then he gives an example of their bold arrogance. They do not tremble when they revile something. The word is glories. We'll talk about that in a minute, what's going on with that. The New American Standard Bible translates it angelic majesties. They do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties. And how do they translate? This is one of the questions we're going to talk about in a minute. But what we can say here is that Peter clearly believes that these glories or angelic majesties are so far above the false teachers that they should be trembling when they revile them. There is this arrogance and presumption, this audacity that they have, that they are reviling them when they ought to be trembling in doing so. The word revile here translates the Greek word blasphemeo, from which we get our word to blaspheme or blasphemy. And I think in this context, it has something of the flavor that we associate with that word. The false teachers should be in awe of these angelic majesties or whatever they are. They are above these false teachers, but the false teachers are showing some kind of arrogant, audacious contempt. They see themselves as somehow superior to these angelic majesties or whatever they are. Okay, so something like that is going on. Peter then contrasts their arrogance with the behavior of angels of greater might and power. And in some way that we will have to talk about, these angels do not do this behavior. They do not revile or blaspheme. So that much is clear. They are arrogantly reviling or blaspheming something that they shouldn't, whereas angels of greater might and power don't do that sort of thing. Sort of. Okay. Now, Peter then compares the false teachers to unreasoning animals. We as human beings are made in the image of God. By nature, we can make moral judgments. We can understand the world. We can differentiate between right and wrong and choose to do what is right. But it is as if the false teachers have abandoned the power to reason morally. They just act like animals do, following their animal urges without restraint. I mean, even we know this about animals. I mean, even, you know, you like your dog, maybe you love your dog, but you're aware that the dog is a dog. I mean, it's just a dog. It does what dogs do. All dogs do what dogs do. But human beings have this capacity to actually step back and look and say, well, you know, my animal self kind of feels like going that way, but I can stop and think about this and think about whether that's the way to go or not. Well, the false teachers here are like animals in that they're just following nature without restraint. Well, such animals in this world are destined to be captured and destroyed, and such destruction is what will happen to the false teachers. That seems to be clear enough as well. Now, Peter, in saying that, has not abandoned the issue of these false teachers arrogantly reviling angelic majesties or whatever that is, because he's tied it together here. We see in verse 12 that his analogy of the unreasoning animals is used to describe the false teachers reviling things of which they have no knowledge. That is, this is repeating what he was just talking about. They're reviling these angelic majesties, or whatever we're going to call them, even though they don't really understand them or know what they're talking about. So, we can say with a certain amount of confidence about verses 10 through 12 that Peter is giving another example of the evil of the false teachers, the evil that is going to lead to their destruction. That evil is a kind of bold arrogance shown in the way they revile or blaspheme angelic majesties or something like that. They should in fact be trembling to be so audacious as to revile in this way. Even the greater angels themselves do not do this. Okay, that's what he says. Now, that sort of sounds like an explanation of what he said, except it doesn't really explain anything. I mean, what was he saying here? Who are the false teachers reviling? What are these glories that they're reviling? And what does that mean? Why are they doing that? I mean, what sort of behavior are we talking about? And how does Peter know that these greater angels don't practice this kind of reviling that we're talking about here? Where does he get that idea from? Was it revealed to him from God that angels don't do this? And why is it that I would care? I mean, what is it exactly at stake about how angels look at this stuff? And then beyond the interpretive questions, there are the questions of application. What does Peter expect us to do with this? What is his point? It sounds like I could look at this and say, okay, as long as I keep myself from saying bad things about angels, then I'm okay. I mean, I've managed to avoid the problem that he's speaking against here. But that seems a little strange. I mean, maybe in this culture this was the big problem, is that people went around cursing angels all day, and he had to really get down on them because they shouldn't be cursing angels. But that whole way of looking at it is just a little weak. It seems like there's something else going on here. And this is the spot where I face that question. I could just say at this point, well, there are some really hard questions involved with this and a lot of details that we would have to look at moving on. And then I could go to the next passage, which I have to say, the next passage, next couple of verses that we're going to look at, I think I actually know what's going on. So I'm looking forward to talking about that next week. That will be fun. But I decided that it seems like we ought to try to look at this and see what is it. Can we have any idea here of what it is that Peter's doing? So I'm going to try to do that and see if we can make some progress at least. At least I can show you some of the choices that need to be made. Sometimes we encounter passages that just don't seem to give us enough information to sort things out. This analogy is what I'm going to use in what we're going to do today. I picture the process of interpreting passages like these as like you're walking down a road and you come to a fork in the road. Okay, so am I going to take A or B? Well, the thing is it's not certain. It seems like, upon consideration, that probably B is the more likely way that I should take this. So I go down road B, and I come to another fork in the road. And now I have to choose whether I'm going to go down road 1 or 2. And I think about it, and I say, well, I'm not certain between these, but it seems more likely in this case that 2 is the better choice. So I've gone down road B, and I've gone down road 2, and so I come to another fork in the road, and this time I have to choose between X and Y. And, well, this is a tough choice this time, but X seems to be the better choice. And so if you look at where I am, I have arrived at B to X. That's where I ended up. But you notice that if you have enough of those forks in the road, that when you look at where you arrived, you realize all it would take is for me to have made the wrong choice on one of those forks in the road, and it would put me in the wrong place. If I was wrong at the beginning and I was supposed to have taken A, then I'm way off over here when I'm supposed to be over here. Well, I would like to say that that never happens in the Bible when we come to passages in the Bible, but the fact is that sometimes it does. As, for example, this passage that we're looking at today. So you arrive at a conclusion, but you recognize that that conclusion is based on a series of choices that you made along the way, each of which you could justify, but each of which you have to acknowledge, that could have gone another way. If you looked at this right, maybe I put that thing together right. In this passage, there are a series of interpretive forks in the road that we have to take. And so I've decided to take you on a tour through the interpretive forks in the road that we have in this little passage that we were just looking at. And what I hope to accomplish by that, I'm not sure that I could exactly explain it to you, but I have hope that this will not be a total waste of your time. That's all I can say. It is my great hope that this will not be a total waste of your time. Let me remind you of something before we come to our first fork in the road. I'll remind you what we talked about several weeks back, that this chapter in 2 Peter, the second chapter, is clearly related to the book of Jude. If you go through, it's just unescapable. There are so many parallels between what the book of Jude says and what 2 Peter says in this chapter. I have argued that Peter wrote first and Jude borrowed from him. That's not an inescapable conclusion, but it is what seems to make the best sense to me given the evidence. Many would argue that Jude wrote first. Some would argue that they were both relying on pre-existing material and they were both borrowing from something else. Let me read to you the passage in Jude 8, it is, that is parallel to the one that we're looking at here, because we're going to have to consider both of them. Yet in the same manner, these men also, by dreaming, defile the flesh and reject authority and revile glories. But Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a reviling judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." But these men revile the things which they do not understand, and the things which they know by nature, like unreasoning animals, by these things they are destroyed. So you can see that there are a number of parallels just in that little section between what Peter said and what Jude said. We'll look specifically at some things in a minute, but notice we see Peter speaks of the defiling desires of the flesh, as we saw last week. Jude says that these ones defile the flesh. Peter says that they reject authority. We talked about that last week. Jude here says they reject authority. Peter says a very strange and specific phrase that only occurs anything like this in these contexts. He says they revile glories. And Jude says they revile glories. That's one of the things that just signals how close a relationship there is between 2 Peter and Jude. This is a very unusual phrase that you don't find anywhere else in the New Testament, and yet both of them are using that same phrase in a place that is obviously very parallel. So there's some sort of relationship here, it's clear. And then Peter says that angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them. Jude doesn't say that exactly, but he says something that seems to match it quite well. In fact, it sounds like he's giving an example of the general statement that Peter makes. Because what Jude says is, Michael the archangel did not give a reviling judgment against Satan. So Peter is saying, angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them, which we'll talk about in a minute. Jude specifically says, Michael the archangel did not give a reviling judgment against Satan. Okay, let's pause a minute here and ask this question. Where did Jude get this story about Michael fighting with Satan over the body of Moses? You may be thinking back, if you're aware at all of the Old Testament, you may be thinking back and say, gee, I'm not aware of where that came from in the Old Testament. And the reason that you're not aware of it is because it does not come from the Old Testament. There is no story about Michael fighting with Satan over the body of Moses. There is an ancient book called The Testament of Moses. We have part of that book. We don't have the last part of the book, and that seems to be the part where this story came from. The reason we would think that is that we have other writers who came later who said, you know that story that Jude tells about Michael fighting with Satan over the body of Moses? That came from the Testament of Moses. Okay, so here we have Jude referring back to a story that is not in the canonical scriptures, but it comes from this document called the Testament of Moses, probably. And we face that question again, just like we did a couple weeks ago when we saw Peter and Jude seemingly referring to a story from another book called 1 Enoch, which is also not in the Old Testament. We face that same question again. What did they think about these books? What did Jude think when he was referring to this story? Did he believe that the Testament of Moses was in fact telling of something that really happened? And where did he get that idea? I don't have a good answer to that question. It's just a question that we can't help asking ourselves. Where did he get this? Why did he think that was the case? At any rate, we can say here that Peter and Jude both use very similar language in this section. All right, so now you're going to come with me. We're going to go down this road, and we're going to come to forks in the road, and we're going to make choices about how we're going to take what we find there. Fork in the road number one. Is it legitimate, yes or no, for me to use Jude to better understand Peter? Because let's think about this. Many people think that Jude wrote first and Peter borrowed from him. If that were the case, Jude gives this very specific story about Michael fighting with Satan over the body of Moses. Peter's version then is much more general. He's taken the specific story that Jude told, and he's just generalized it. And he said, you know, well, greater angels don't revile in this way. But I have argued that Peter wrote first. Like I say, it's not a sure thing, but right now this would be my conclusion, that Peter wrote first, and Jude borrowed from him. And if that's the case, then Peter makes a general statement that the greater angels do not make reviling judgments in this way. Jude then gives a much more specific example, if that's what it is. But we don't know. Does Jude think that he's making the same point in that story that Peter was? Is he taking off from what Peter said and making a new sort of different kind of point with his specific example? Can I assume that Jude and Peter are making the same point with this stuff about angels and reviling and stuff that they're saying there? Well, my tentative conclusion at this point is that they are making the same point, and so I can compare both Peter and Jude when I try to understand either one. But you notice right there, we're making an assumption. Maybe that's not true. Maybe Jude has a different point. I am going to operate on the assumption that they are making a similar point and use Jude to try to help understand what's going on in Peter. Okay, fork in the road number two. I'm going to make that assumption. Peter and Jude both use this language about reviling, blaspheming against glories. What does that mean? What are we going to do with that? Like I said, the New American Standard Bible translates this angelic majesties. They do not bring reviling judgments against angelic majesties. But literally, it's just the word glory in the plural. This is an unusual use of the word glory. It's unusual for it to be in the plural. In the New Testament, there's only one other place besides these passages that we're looking at here where we see the word glory in the plural, and that's in 1 Peter. Peter says that the Spirit predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that were to follow. And in that context, it seems fairly clear, by using glory in the plural there, he means glorious things. He predicted the glorious things that were to follow after Christ's sufferings. Well, in our passage in 2 Peter, it seems to be a personal noun, a noun that's referring to persons or beings. So to revile glories in this context seems to mean to revile glorious persons or glorious beings of some sort. And given the various shades of meaning to the word glory, I think it's best to translate it something like great ones or something like that. Now, who are these glorious beings, these great ones that we're talking about here? In the context of both Peter and Jude, it does seem like he is talking about supernatural beings like angels. Now, could you take it another way? I think you might be able to put it together in a way that would take it another way. But at this fork in the road, I am taking the fork that says, yes, the New American Standard was at least on the right track when it translated this something like angelic majesties, that we're talking about great and supernatural beings that here in this case. So something like angels or something along that line. And we'll see some of the contextual things here in a minute that might suggest that that's what's going on. Okay, so fork in the road number three. another choice that has to be made. Peter says, "Whereas angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them before the Lord." Well, you know, you're probably quite familiar with the fact that when we have pronouns, in somebody's talking and they use a pronoun, the pronoun refers to something, and sometimes it's not immediately apparent what the pronoun is referring to. Who is them is the question here. Well, one obvious choice would be the false teachers. The false teachers revile angelic majesties, but the angels do not bring a reviling judgment against the false teachers. So the false teachers revile the angels, but the angels don't revile them. That would make sense. I mean, by itself, that would make sense, right? That would work. If that's what he means, it's not immediately obvious what he's getting at, I don't think. How would he know that angels don't bring a reviling judgment against the false teachers? Maybe the angels hang around up there and they're just talking the false teachers down all the time. I mean, how do we know? How would I know such a thing? I mean, maybe there's an answer to that question. But before we try to answer that question, we want to consider the possibility here that he means somebody else by them. And I think the parallel passage in Jude suggests another possibility. Remember, now this is where I'm going to use Jude to try to unpack what's happening in Peter. Peter makes a general statement about the angels. Angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them before the Lord. Jude, however, seems to be giving a specific example of an angel's response. And his story goes, Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a reviling judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." So Peter's giving a general statement about great angels not bringing a reviling judgment against them. Jude gives an example. Michael did not bring a reviling judgment against Satan. Michael not condemning Satan seems to be a specific example of angels not condemning them. So this gives us a clue, then, I think, to another way of understanding who them is. Them is a group that could include Satan. Them could be glorious supernatural beings who have come to be worthy in some sense of being reviled or rejected, like Satan. In other words, the them is the great ones, the angelic majesties that he was talking about. Remember that in chapter 2, we have already seen talk about fallen angels and how God has reserved them for judgment. So we can interpret Peter's statement like this: the false teachers do not tremble when they revile great supernatural beings, whereas angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against those great supernatural beings. So the false teachers are reviling angelic beings that other angels will not revile, will not condemn. And that would explain the parallelism then between Jude and Peter, because that's the example that Jude gives, is Michael will not condemn Satan, but leaves that to God to do. So that is the fork in the road that I am leaning toward taking at this spot. The false teachers revile great supernatural beings, but the greater angels like Michael do not revile great supernatural beings like Satan. They leave him to God. Okay, this brings us to fork in the road number 4. What are we talking about when we're talking about false teachers reviling glorious angelic beings? What is that? What are they doing? What has led them to do such a thing? What sort of thing could we be talking about? After all, I mean, the New Testament doesn't say nice things about creatures like Satan. It's not like, I mean, we pull any punches when we're talking about the glorious being that fell, that is Satan. I mean, we talk him down pretty roughly, actually. So what exactly is going on here? What is it that Peter that they're doing that Peter doesn't like. Maybe they're just down on angels in general in some way that we do not know. Maybe they don't believe in angels. That seems to have been the situation, for example, of the Sadducees, although it's a little bit debated exactly what it is they believed. But, you know, it's not as if there weren't groups that would embrace certain aspects of the Jewish religion, and we could see it happening in Christianity as well, perhaps, but would just say, well, I don't believe in angels or something like that. And that's possible, and maybe Peter's really worried about this. There's something really bad about not believing in angels. That's possible. But again, the example from Jude of Michael and Satan may give us a more specific picture, and this is what I'm thinking is what's going on. Maybe the false teachers are bad-mouthing angels because of the fallen angels, just like in the example of Michael and Satan. That is, you have Michael, the archangel, who is dealing with a supernatural being who has turned and rebelled against God. And the question is, how is he responding to that? So maybe that's what the false teachers are responding to, is the stories about angels who have done evil and turned away from God, and they have taken it upon themselves to arrogantly revile them. Perhaps the false teachers are familiar with the stories of fallen angels. Remember what we saw back in verse 4. Peter seemed to be drawing on this story from 1 Enoch, a very strange story about angels who came to earth and mated with human women, and God cast them into darkness reserved for judgment and all of this stuff. Now, I mean, that's another debatable question, is what exactly was Peter drawing on there? But he has talked about angels who sinned and were cast into darkness awaiting the day of judgment. So maybe the false teachers also know those stories about angels who have sinned and were cast into darkness awaiting the day of judgment, and it was those stories that aroused their contempt, perhaps for the whole idea of angels at all. That is, they're responding, they've read 1 Enoch, they're looking at that and saying, they're saying something like, the whole idea of angels is ridiculous because look at this incredible, contemptuous, stupid, weird story about angels sinning and all of that sort of thing. What I'm suggesting is that it is possible that Peter is saying angels like Michael have responded to this picture of the fallen angels in a way that is different than the false teachers have responded to those stories. Peter and Jude would be saying, well, the false teachers are always bad-mouthing angels because of these stories of fallen angels, but greater angels like Michael do not arrogantly presume to judge fallen angels. They leave that to God. Okay, well, again, can I say that is what's going on? Well, no, I don't think I can say that. But it makes sense. It fits. It makes the language that Jude and Peter are using fairly tight. And it ties it together with the stuff that's already been talked about these angels who sinned and were cast into darkness and so on. So, not bad. There might be something to that. Okay, that brings us to our last fork in the road. If you're counting, this is number 5. In verse 12, Peter says that the false teachers revile things of which they have no knowledge, and that they will, in their destruction, also be destroyed. And now the question is, again, we have a pronoun here. Who's it referring to? Who is there talking about? So let me remind you of the context here. Peter compares the false teachers to irrational animals destined to be captured and destroyed. He says they revile things of which they have no knowledge. And then he says that in their destruction, they will also be destroyed. New American Standard thinks that it is referring back to the unreasoning animals. You can see in their translation. They say they will, in the destruction of those creatures, also be destroyed. They've decided that it is the analogy is being repeated by Peter here. They're like unreasoning animals who are captured and destroyed, and so the false teachers will be destroyed in the same way that those unreasoning animals are. It's just he hasn't really added anything to what he's saying. He's just sort of repeated it. That's the way New American Standard takes it. It's the destruction of the unreasoning animals that is like the destruction that's going to come on them here. But there is another option. Remember, just before, Peter says, they're reviling things of which they have no knowledge, and they will in their destruction also be destroyed. Well, the idea immediately before the word there is these things of which they have no knowledge, the things which they revile. And what is it in this context that they are reviling? They are reviling the great ones, the glorious ones, the angelic majesties. They are reviling these supernatural beings. So here's what Peter could be saying at this spot. They revile great supernatural beings which they don't understand, but when those great supernatural beings are destroyed, the false teachers will also be destroyed. Notice how that ties in with what he talked about earlier, those angels who sinned and who are awaiting the day of judgment. So if we go in this direction, which I find myself leaning toward just the littlest bit, it kind of wraps it up and pulls it together a little bit more, and it reinforces some of what we've been saying. Where is it that we learned that fallen angels or these, whatever they are, these supernatural beings, will one day be destroyed? Well, that was in verse 4. He talked about the angels who sinned and who are being held in reserved for judgment. So it suggests that the fallen angels mentioned by Peter in verse 4 are actually in view in verses 10 through 12. What is this reviling of angelic majesties that these false teachers are involved in? Well, whatever they're involved in, it's tied in with this picture of the angels who sinned and who are reserved for judgment. Their response to that has been something arrogant and wrong, unlike the response of someone like Michael, who would not himself bring a reviling judgment against Satan, another sort of fallen angel, or whatever Satan is, which is difficult to say. Okay, so having done all of that stuff and totally lost you, I'm sure, let me paraphrase what, if we put all of those choices together as we go down this road, what would Peter be saying then in this? It would be something like this. And I'm going to throw in some of Jude, and I'm filling this out to try to make it a little clearer what he's saying. The false teachers are daring and arrogant. They do not tremble at their own audacity when they blaspheme against the angels because of these stories of fallen angels. But look, angels of greater might and power do not revile the fallen angels in this way. Look at how Michael dealt with that great and fallen supernatural being, Satan. He did not personally revile and condemn him, but called on the Lord to curse him instead. In doing this, these false teachers are not acting from wisdom and moral reasoning. They are acting like irrational animals, pursuing their natural desires without restraint, and like those animals, they will be destroyed. They have no understanding of the great supernatural beings, like the fallen angels that they are reviling, and on the great day of judgment, when those fallen angels are destroyed, they will be destroyed also. Okay, so what are we going to do with all that? Now that I've said all that, where are we? What are we going to do? First of all, it is my intention to take you down this road to show you the choices that are being made there. I do want to communicate to you that in a passage like this, the conclusions that we come to are somewhat tentative because there are so many little choices that have to be made along the way. And at each spot, you might come in and say, well, yeah, but what about, and argue on the other side, and it depends at each one of those forks in the road, how strong is your understanding of what's going on there and the argument that you have for why you would go in that direction. And sometimes we just don't know enough to be able to be definitive. Notice that I'm filling in, I'm giving background and saying, well, okay, maybe this is what they're thinking and this is what has led to this situation. That's not wrong to do, but I can't speak with any great authority about those speculations. I'm just trying to put something in place that explains all the pieces. So the very first fork in the road I came to when I said, I'm going to decide that I can use Jude to understand Peter, maybe I was wrong to do that. Maybe Jude is not doing the same thing. So I'm left trying to understand Peter using material that's not relevant. Now, we do recognize that sooner or later, if I'm going to study the whole Bible, I have to go study Jude, and then I have to figure out what Jude is doing with this stuff. But maybe that choice about them, you know, they don't revile them. Maybe it is saying that the angels don't revile the false teachers instead of don't revile these great angelic majesties or however we describe them. It seems to me with the evidence of Jude that it is stronger to take it in the way that those greater angels don't revile these evil supernatural beings just like Michael did not revile Satan. But it's not certain that that's the case. I mean, there are these choices to be made. So why am I telling you this? Why would I want you to know that it's this hard to sort this stuff out here? Am I trying to create skeptics? This is always my fear when we look at passages like this, that the result of it is that I'm going to send you away saying, I guess you can't really know anything in the Bible, huh? And that, I mean, that's the last thing in the world that I want to do. I encounter this at Gutenberg when I'm working with students and we're doing micro and we're looking at something in the Gospel of John and or something like that, and I just go home thinking, I just convinced one more person that they will never understand the Bible. And, you know, that's the last thing in the world that I want to do. But I want to be honest about what it is we face. With these verses that we're looking at here, we cannot do anything less than the process that I was trying to take us through there to try to sort out what's happening. We have to ask each of those questions at those spots. What's going on with this stuff? And we have to recognize that our answers may be somewhat tentative at certain spots, and that affects how we're going to end up taking it. Like I say, I want to be realistic about this. I mentioned before that what we're looking at next week, I feel fairly confident that we can figure out what it is that Peter is getting at in that passage. He makes a reference to the story of Balaam. I mean, it's probably Balaam, but we anglicize it, which is usually Balaam. Isn't that how people usually say it? I think so. So that's in the Bible. That's like actually in the Old Testament. And you can go back and read it, and I think you can actually make sense of what's happening in that story, although it's a little bit tricky. But ultimately, I think you can make sense of what's happening in that story. And so Peter's example is actually quite clear. And I think it's very helpful example. It helps us to understand what he's concerned about in this letter, I think. So there's an example of where I think we will go away feeling somewhat satisfied that we have gotten on top of what it is that Peter was saying. Here, that satisfaction may be a little more elusive. It may be hard to come to because there are so many choices that have to be made. I just feel like every now and again that it's important for us as people who are the disciples of Jesus and students of this book to acknowledge that sometimes it's like this. In this case, I think it certainly is. Next, then, let me say, probably, hopefully, this is the last that we will be talking about fallen angels for a while. I don't have a lot to say about angels, actually. It is not something that I've looked into a lot. But let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that what I described here today is something like what Peter is getting at. This helps us, as I said, to sort of tie together what he said in verse 4 with what he's saying here. And it may shed some light on what's happening in the passage, although it's all very difficult to put together. But in verse 4, Peter talked about God's judgment on angels who sinned. And today's passage suggests that the false teachers might know these stories and might be blaspheming perhaps the very idea of angels because of these stories about these angels who who did these very strange and evil things. Okay, so putting the two passages together, Peter is saying something like this about the false teachers. They arrogantly condemn the angels because of the stories about the fallen angels, but in fact their own behavior is like the fallen angels, and they will come under the same judgment that is described for the fallen angels. Like I say, putting kind of verse 4 and then this section together. You may recall that there are a number of parallels between what Peter says in verse 4 and a book called First Enoch. I mentioned that earlier. First Enoch tells this weird story of angels who come to earth, mate with human women, and were thrown into captivity and darkness until the day of judgment. And the question we were exploring when we were looking at that was, first of all, is Peter referring to First Enoch and those sorts of stories? And then, if he is, does he believe that that's true? Does he think that that's in fact what happened? And I was suggesting that perhaps Peter isn't addressing the question of whether that actually happened. What is essential is that the false teachers are aware of these stories and are reviling angelic majesties because of those sorts of stories, that they have painted this picture of the angels in a certain way. And so Peter's point then could be not that those stories are true, but rather that the false teachers have no grounds for their contempt. In fact, they themselves are going to be judged for the very kinds of behavior that they are ridiculing in the fallen angels. So that was what I was trying to say 2 weeks ago, is the idea that not so much that Peter is endorsing or not endorsing this particular story from First Enoch, but that the false teachers take that story seriously, and he's telling them, in essence, you've drawn the wrong conclusion from it. What it shows us is a God who will not put up with rebellion, even from his supernatural beings like angels. So what makes you think that he's going to put up with rebellion in you? Something like that. Again, what I just said there is dependent on whether all of those little pieces that I'm putting together there have been put together in the right way. All right, finally then, let me just speak to the question of what does Peter want us to take away from all this? I mean, it depends on what he was saying, so this is a little bit tricky to answer this question, but why do this at all? Is he really concerned that having the right theology about angels is somehow really important, and that a person who doesn't have the right theology about angels obviously could not be a believer and is going to be condemned in the end or something? Where is he coming from? What is motivating this kind of language? Well, I think we can say this. I think that the phrases that he uses to describe the false teachers here help us to see the kind of thing he's concerned about. He calls them daring or bold, arrogant. They do not tremble when they should be trembling. They revile what they do not understand. So I think the sort of thing that Peter is seeing in the false teachers is an arrogance, a superior attitude towards the things of the faith. They have seen through the angels. They're above all that stuff. And what is significant about that is not what they think about angels, but what they think about God. That they're easy sort of rejection and blaspheming against the angels really represents the casual attitude that they take toward God. Throughout Peter's letter, we see that the false prophets do not take the message of the prophets seriously, of the Old Testament. They do not take the message of the apostles seriously. And their superior attitude to the angels is just a manifestation of this bigger problem of arrogance. Peter is describing them over and over again as licentious. They indulge the flesh however they want to. They reject authority. They have put themselves in the community of believers, saying, we're with you. They're even presuming to teach the believers, but they're doing it in such a way that they are teaching things and pursuing a way of life that has pushed aside the real picture of who God is and what he wants and what he has promised. And so this attitude that they have, this easy sort of, without trembling or thinking, what in the world am I doing? You know, I am making definitive pronouncements against beings that are that are way above me and created by God for his purposes and so on. It is that arrogance, the fact that they don't tremble, that I think Peter is talking about. So it's not angels that is the issue. It is their lack of humility and reverence before the God who is going to judge the angels and going to judge them, something like that. Thinking about it in that way, then, we can understand what Peter is concerned about and how we can take this away and think about it ourselves. It's not probably going to be true in our place in history that the question of angels is going to be a question that we're going to be wrestling with people over, that that's going to be the thing where someone's arrogance might show itself. But we do see all the time people who speak out against Christianity or certain forms of Christianity or religion in general, who are arrogantly contemptuous of those positions. They are clearly above that. They have seen through that. They know much more than those who believe. I just encountered that today. I was looking at something. I don't remember what it was, but I came to something on the internet that had something to do with Christianity, and then I made the mistake of looking at the comments. You know, I have gotten to the point where I don't look at the comments on anything about anything anymore. If I go to YouTube and I look at somebody, you know, playing a folk song or something, I don't want to look at the comments underneath because you just know it's going to be, you know, this war is going to break out over something. Well, I mean, so all the comments were about how ridiculous Christianity was and how people who believe it are naive and stupid and so forth, with a very sort of superior air, you know, that sort of, the evidence that I am a superior intellect is that I have not bought that ridiculous story, you know, that sort of thing. But I notice oftentimes when I listen to criticisms of Christians or Christianity, let's take an example. They might point their finger at preachers who they would say, look at that guy on TV. He's obviously in it for the money. I mean, he's always raising money, and he's getting these poor people to send in their last dime so that he can travel around in his Winnebago and, you know, and has five yachts and all of that kind of stuff. And so they will contemptuously dismiss Christianity because of that. Look at, you know, these guys are just in it for the money. And yet, if you think about it, there is no more profound critique of using religion as a means to profit off of other people than you find in the Bible. Christianity itself, in the teaching of Jesus and the apostles and in the Old Testament as well, would look at that and say, that's not it. That's what the false thing looks like. That's the thing that's passing it off as religion or a relationship with God, but that's not the real deal. So there is this certain arrogance of standing up and pointing the finger at the Bible and saying, you know, I'm above all that, when in fact a serious and humble look at the Bible would suggest that the Bible actually has more to say about that topic than I do myself, that I'm not in this position of superiority, but in fact I am one like everyone else who needs to be critiqued by the biblical authors and the God of the Bible and not the other way around. Well, that I think is the kind of thing that Peter is getting at here. The issue, particular issue of the angels and what was going on there, we may never know until that day when we know all the answers to these questions. We may never know exactly what was going on there. But I think what Peter's concerned about is that arrogant and cavalier attitude towards the things of God, that someone has put themselves above this without any need to actually think about or submit to how does God want me to live. Greed becomes justified under my religious beliefs. Sensuality and debauchery become justified under my religious beliefs. And I have this arrogant sort of dismissal of those who would say otherwise because I know better and I've seen through all of that stuff. I think that's what the kind of thing that's happening here. And the angels is just a particular example that happens to be true in this case. So the real issue for us becomes then that question of arrogance. Am I willing to be confronted in my questions? I mean, I look at the Bible, I have questions about things. I have questions about this. I have questions about Jude referring to the testament of Moses, if he is. What was he doing? What was going on with that stuff? But there are two ways to ask that sort of question. You can ask that sort of question from the perspective of, I don't have all the answers. And it seems to me that what I've seen in the Bible commends itself as true and cutting right to the heart of what I need to see and believe and repent of. So I'm coming to it not as a critic, but as a student. I want to understand what this is. I think Peter was saying that the false teachers here were coming to this whole question of angels, whatever was going on there, not as students of Jesus, but as critics. Like W.C. Fields' famous story, a friend of his found him looking in the Bible, right? And he was shocked. What are you doing looking in the Bible? And he said, I'm looking for loopholes. So I think that's the sort of thing that Peter is talking about here. Their response to this angel stuff, whatever it might be, is basically, I'm looking for loopholes. I'm not submissive to how God has revealed himself here. I'm trying to find ways to avoid it and be superior in the process, see myself as above it all in the process. So that, I think, is what's happening in the section. What exactly is going on with all of the angelic majesties and all of that stuff is tricky, and there are many different places where we have to make choices. But I think looking at the rest of what Peter's doing, something like that is his concern. And that's something we can take to heart, because that sort of arrogance is endemic. It is a natural part of the human condition, and we need to fight it in ourselves and not submit to it in others. Okay, so we can have some time here now for any questions or comments that you might have.
Thanks, Ron. I personally think you went down the right forks. But I have a question. To me, there's a lot of things in the Bible that, quote, need some re-explanation to put them, quote, in our understanding. You know, like when Jesus says, ye are the salt of the earth, that really doesn't have any meaning to us today. And, you know, for the widows and orphans, you know, we have certain programs and inheritance rights and so on. And so I'm just wondering if these stories, like Enoch and the Testament of Moses, were these books and so on that were known to, quote, the educated? Or was this, you know, like parents may say, oh, well, the book of Moses says so and so and so and so.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I don't know. I'm not sure. My impression is that these stories were fairly widely known. So, yeah, I have not. But I don't know if I have or if we have enough evidence to speak definitively on that. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking is at stake there? What difference would it make if they were stories that were primarily known to the well-educated?
Well, what came to my mind is, like, sometimes you hear stories about miraculous things happening, like missions and so on. And I kind of see a little parallel with that, because, you know, like, oh, God wouldn't do this. This is just fairy tales and so on, trying to ensnare you into Christianity.
Okay. And so you were thinking the issue is maybe it was the less educated who would buy these stories, and the more educated maybe would see them as fables or something?
Not necessarily.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Because I see in today, I think probably almost without parallel in history, people who are so educated but so ignorant at the same time.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah,
because you get people that are so educated And I don't mean to make any barbs here, but like in philosophy and certain other things, but they haven't actually read the Bible. And people that, you know, about different religions say, and, you know, they won't do this, but if you clearly studied what was written, you would know what these are up to. Okay. And so I'm wondering if we have this kind of thing going on, that people who are so wise in studying the things that they think should be studied, i.e. a lot of things today, but they ignore these other things. Like, for instance, I'm thinking we can get parallels to some of the things that happen, miracles and so on, and different types of things, and saying like, oh, well, God wouldn't do that.
Okay. Yeah, it could be. Well, the best I can say is that could be true. I couldn't say for sure.
Okay.
Is it possible that as I read the description of these false teachers, and I think I agree with you that they think they're pretty hot stuff and have an inside track and have a certain personal authority to say these things, that they're reviling the obedient angels, not angels in general?
Well, it all depends on how you draw the parallels in here and how many of them go across. We have Peter saying they revile whatever angelic majesties or whatever, however we're going to say that, whereas angels of greater might and power do not pass a reviling judgment against them. Okay, so now we do have to sort out who's the them. And the parallel is Michael not reviling Satan. Okay, so in the story of Michael, it was someone Michael would not revile even though he was worthy of it. Satan deserves to come under the judgment of God, but Michael was not presumptuously pronouncing that judgment himself, but saying, God, deal with you. May God curse you. May God judge you. So if what Peter's talking about in the angels not passing judgment on them is exemplified in the thing about Michael, then a robust reading of the story about Michael is he's not passing judgment on someone that was in fact worthy of it. So that would be what kind of why I was leaning in the direction that it's the fallen angels, the ones who sinned that Peter just talked about earlier on, that are in view here and how they respond to that story.
And they're stepping up saying, Michael should have just told the guy to get stuffed, because after all, he's an angel. And these guys don't scare me. I'm saying if I'd been there, I'd have told the devil to just take a hike.
I mean, yeah, well, maybe. Again, we have to have some picture of what they're doing, right? So I have a hard time believing that the problem, as Peter would see it, is that these false teachers were getting on board with Michael and the good angels and saying, yeah, they're good, but those bad angels sure are bad, aren't they? I mean, how terrible can it be for these guys to be condemning the evil angels for having committed immorality? That doesn't seem like such a bad thing. I'm proposing that they are blaspheming, reviling the general idea of the greatness of these beings because of the stories like that. So they just reject Michael and the whole deal. They might very well be those who just reject the idea of angels altogether, but their reason for doing it would be, say, look at these ridiculous stories about angels sleeping with women and all that kind of stuff.
But wouldn't that be their rejection of authority?
Yes.
Because if they're saying Michael should have just taken it upon himself to make the condemnation, and Michael didn't have that authority, and so these guys are claiming, I don't need God's authority. I don't have to have permission from God. I'll do it myself.
Maybe. I'm seeing it a little bit differently. It's more like someone who would say, let's take it on a broader thing. You expect me to believe in Jesus? I mean, stories about a guy who walks on the water and spits in a guy's eyes so he can see and all of this. I mean, babies and naive people and uneducated people believe those kind of stories. The whole picture is kind of being rejected because of these elements that they feel superior to. Look at this. I'm obviously better than to believe something like that, so I'm just not buying the whole thing. I don't know that I don't know that that's the case, but that's kind of the way I was picturing it, is that they're looking at the stories in these accounts and just saying, this just, the whole thing is ridiculous. And thus, more seriously, calling into question the authority of the Old Testament itself. Not because First Enoch is in the Old Testament or Testament of Moses is in the Old Testament, but because the story of angels is told us in the Old Testament. And if I revile them because of these other stories and just reject the whole thing, then I have, in essence, rejected the authority of God. I've kind of thrown the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing. That's what I'm picturing. Is that, in fact, what's happening? It's very difficult to say. That's the thing that makes the most sense to me right now. I can see how that might work, but a number of places to make decisions. But that's what I'm saying, if that makes any sense.
And their whole goal is to exploit them with false words, to follow their own sensuality.
Yes. And we'll talk about that more next time. This idea of exploiting them, I think, is really at the heart of Peter's concern. He is concerned about the impact that people like this can have on a community of believers. He is warning them why it is so important that they don't listen to them, why they don't go that way, I think is his concern. And this passage makes it look like it's really important that you don't go that way because they'll give you the wrong story about angels. I don't think that's what's happening. I think it's the way they have dealt with this question of the angels shows their arrogance and is an example of their disinclination to submit to authority and that kind of thing.
Ron, I was wondering if the word glories, synonym for the word glories would be luminaries?
Yes, it's possible.
And the reason I ask is because there's a lot in the passage between chapters 1 and chapter 2 about knowledge and understanding, but mm-hmm. Peter opens the book with saying, we've given you enough for you to understand how to live in godliness. And then he continues with this idea that they're supposed to follow their faith with knowledge. And then he goes on to criticize the false teachers who lack understanding and lack knowledge. And they're criticizing the luminaries without knowledge, without understanding. So I'm wondering if perhaps, I mean, granted, they still might be fallen angels, but isn't it that the arrogance of these men is to assume they have more wisdom than the great?
Well, yes, I think it is. I'm still not sure how you're seeing that related to taking glories as luminaries, though. But apart from that part, yeah, and then yeah, I agree with what you said. Well, I'm not sure about that. What you mean by that?
I'm not saying that I have a better explanation of the passage than you are. I'm just putting that in there as a detail that we might consider later.
Yeah. Well,
just the idea that the issue seems to me is wisdom. That these false teachers are claiming to be smarter and wiser and know more about how to live life than, say, the apostles or even the angels.
Yeah. No, that's right. I think that is the kind of issue that's involved. That's why Peter would be concerned about it. Why the word glory in the plural in that spot, if it is referring to angelic beings or something like that? I mean, in the Old Testament, the idea of glory is associated with God, and sometimes it's associated with things that we would refer to as angels, so that's a possible way it gets there. The tricky thing is that the word in Greek, before you get into the Old Testament and that stuff, it starts out meaning something like opinion. And glory comes to represent not, it's like what a person has when people think well of them. I have glory. The considered opinion out there is that I'm good or something like that. So there are times when this word can kind of lean in the direction of talking about status, you know, how important is this thing, which is why I was thinking that maybe something like great ones, magnificent ones, or something like that is kind of what's at stake here. These are creatures who, by their nature, are not your run-of-the-mill creatures. These are significant, great, magnificent creatures. And perhaps he's bringing that out because of the not trembling. You ought to be trembling when you're going to presume to be tackling them, something like that. Anyway, we're probably out of time here, so I guess we'll let it go with that. Like I say, I think that's the weirdest of the stuff in 2 Peter. So from here on, I think it'll be a little easier sledding. We'll see. We'll take that on next week.